It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a husband and wife musical team from northern Wisconsin tells us about their show honoring the life of environmentalist John Muir. First, Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer introduced a bill in the U.S. Senate that would decriminalize marijuana if it's passed. Eight states plus the District of Columbia have passed laws allowing the recreational use of pot, while several states in the country allow the use of medical marijuana. Our next guest is here to talk about Schumer's proposed bill and the changing attitudes toward marijuana around the country. Sam Kamen is the Vincente Cederberg Professor of Marijuana Law and Policy at the University of Denver's Sturm College of Law. Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Well, is this a milestone, a marijuana decriminalization bill being introduced in the U.S. Senate?
Well, there's actually been one. Senator Booker and Senator Gillibrand from New York and New Jersey have introduced the Marijuana Justice Act previously. This coming from the party leader is significant, but I would say it's sort of one of a number of steps that we've seen taken recently.
And is it likely that some kind of marijuana legalization law would pass in this Congress or any Congress in the next few years?
Probably not in this Congress, but within the next few years, I think it's quite likely. I think that if the Democrats were to retake the House and or the Senate, that would certainly increase the chances. Right now, while there's some bipartisan support for marijuana legalization, I would say it's not. It hasn't quite yet enjoyed bipartisan support.
I want to give a listen to Senator Schumer talking to Shauna Thomas of Vice News about his bill and why he wanted to introduce it.
I've seen too many people's lives ruined because they had small amounts of marijuana and served time in jail much too long. It affects communities of color disproportionately and unfairly. And ultimately, it's the right thing to do. Freedom. If smoking marijuana doesn't hurt anybody else, why shouldn't we allow people to do it and not make it criminal? We allow the states to decide.
Talk about what seems to me like a pretty rapid change in attitudes toward marijuana around the country, with states legalizing and people in the U.S. Senate saying things that I think not that long ago would have been kind of career poison for a major politician.
Yeah, to say nothing of the former Speaker of the House on the Republican side joining a marijuana business and saying that his views on it have evolved. Things do seem to be changing pretty quickly. It's interesting because, when Attorney General Sessions was nominated, that was sort of the worst nightmare for legalization people. He's been a strong and long time opponent of marijuana law reform. And perhaps for that reason, people have sought legislative solutions to hold him in check.
Yeah, that was a concern when he came into office as Attorney General. Even some Republican senators from places like Colorado that have legalized marijuana were worried about enforcement. Can you talk about how that's all shaken out?
Well, so far it hasn't changed much. Attorney General Sessions repealed the so-called Cole Memo, which had given the states guidance in terms of when and whether the federal government would enforce federal law in those states legalizing marijuana. He didn't really replace it with anything. He left it to the discretion of U.S. attorneys around the country, and most U.S. attorneys, including my own here in Colorado, have taken the same wait-and-see view that was in place during the Obama administration.
And then one of your senators from Colorado, I think, had held off on allowing some nominees to go through until they had some kind of understanding on this. So what happened there?
Well, so Cory Gardner, the Republican senator from my state, said that he had received assurances from Mr. Sessions when he was a senator who had been nominated to head the Justice Department that Sessions wouldn't interfere with states like ours that have chosen to reform their marijuana laws. He said that he felt betrayed when Mr. Sessions did exactly that, and that he would hold up all Justice Department nominations until he received satisfaction. Last week, he announced that he had received those assurances from the president. As I've said a number of times, I hope he got that in writing.
Talking to Sam Kamen from the University of Denver's Law College, looking at marijuana legalization, changes in state laws, and now a couple different proposals introduced in the U.S. Senate trying to decriminalize marijuana. Sam, can you talk about the momentum in states legalizing marijuana recreationally and or medically? We saw a bunch of them. Are there more in the works now?
There are. You know, I just read that there'll be an initiative on the ballot in Utah, of all places. You know, the piecemeal approach of state-by-state, election cycle by election cycle, it's really been working. Law reform advocates haven't won at every ballot box, but they've won far more than they've lost. Marijuana is now legal for some purposes in 60% of the states. And, you know, that I don't see that number going down, and it's certainly going to continue to increase.
All the states are in a gray area, though, aren't they? Because, great, it's legal by state law. It's still illegal everywhere in the country, right, by federal law.
That's exactly right. And so, you know, right now the law reform in states like mine is allowed to continue because of federal acquiescence. That is, the federal government could come in, could arrest people, could shut things down. It's so far chosen not to do so. And so when Sessions said that he was going to repeal the assurances made by the Obama Justice Department, that certainly worried a number of people.
One concern some people have brought up is that, marijuana is being legalized in many states and in those states not being enforced by the federal government. We have businesses coming in, including the one you mentioned with former Speaker John Boehner. But there are people still in prison, in part because of marijuana possession. We heard from Senator Schumer there worried about that. Is there any legislation in the works, or is it part of the federal legislation to retroactively deal with people who have been convicted of marijuana-related crimes?
I haven't seen that in federal legislation. It's certainly been part of legalization in a number of states. But, you know, it's a complicated issue. That is, not all the conduct for which people are have been sentenced to jail or prison, not all that conduct is currently legal. So if you were selling in an unregulated way, if you were selling drugs in addition to marijuana, if you were selling to children, if you were selling, you know, there is lots of marijuana conduct that, you know, was illegal then and remains illegal now. There are very few people, you know, in most states that receive jail time for simple possession. So, you know, the idea that we've filled our prisons with people languishing there for, you know, having one joint in their pocket, that's stretching the truth. You know, I think that there certainly are people who ought to have their prior convictions expunged, but doing that ends up being a little more complicated than most people think.
A lot of people around the country are watching your state and others that have legalized marijuana, especially for recreational purposes. Can you talk about the experience so far in Colorado?
Sure. I think that almost everyone agree that things have gone very well here. You know, it's heavily regulated. It's taxed. It's brought in a lot of money to the state coffers. And, you know, Colorado continues to boom. People are moving here. Unemployment is low. It's certainly not something that has proven to be disastrous for the state. It's been imperfect, and it's been a work in progress. Things like impaired driving require attention. There's been a lot of regulation of edible products to make sure that they're safe and don't fall into the wrong hands. But I think that it would be hard to argue that overall things haven't gone very well here.
Do you get people from other states looking at legalization, looking for a model in Colorado for what to do if and when they do this in other states?
Absolutely. You know, the city of Denver hosts a conference for people around the country that are legalizing or considering legalizing. They get public officials from all around the country. This was an experiment. Colorado was the first jurisdiction really in the world to regulate and tax marijuana for adult use. And, as I said, we didn't get everything perfect, but I think the number of people, not just from the U.S., but from around the world that are looking to our state as a model really speaks to the good work that a lot of people did here.
Sam, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Sam Kamen. He's the Vincente Cederberg Professor of Marijuana Law and Policy at the University of Denver's Sturm College of Law. He joins us to talk about a new bill being introduced in the U.S. Senate that would decriminalize marijuana at the federal level. Coming up, we'll talk with a musical duo from Wisconsin about their traveling show that celebrates the life and writings of conservationist John Muir, and we'll hear a little bit of their music, too. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it's Food Friday. We'll talk about the different types of hot sauce out there around the world and how we can spice up some of our favorite dishes. First, this Sunday is Earth Day, and tomorrow marks the 180th anniversary of the birth of naturalist, environmental philosopher, and author John Muir. And his writings inspired our next guests. Ed Willett and Cheryl Leah are musicians from the town of Highbridge in Ashland County. They make up the husband and wife duo Chance. In 2014, they, along with two others, launched their program, John Muir, University of the Wilderness, which celebrates his work through music and song. The show has traveled across the United States as well as Scotland. Muir spent the first part of his life there before moving to Portage, Wisconsin. Ed Willett is a cellist, guitarist, composer, arranger, and vocalist. Cheryl Leah is a vocalist and poet. Ed and Cheryl, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
It's our pleasure.
Well, before we get to John Muir, let's talk about you two a little bit. You were both out west and came from pretty different musical backgrounds. Cheryl, tell us some about the story of how you met and became a musical team.
From my end of things, I was in a band that was perhaps a very strange band, but I loved it. It was eclectic and weird. It was an Afghani rock band. And
okay.
It was in the 80s when everybody was slamming and doing the, you know, new wave stuff. And so it was this really strange amalgam of new wave and Afghani folk tunes, which was weird by anyone's standards. And so Ed was in the string section of that band. It was a 7-to-9-piece band. And so we actually met in a group. And then we formed a Chance originally as a duo. It became a quartet for 8 years. With a bass player and drummer. And then back to a duo here. And for the show that we're talking about today, our show about John Muir, University of the Wilderness, it's called, we often go out as a quartet, but today we're here in the studio as a duo, so we fluctuate.
And let's talk about John Muir. Ed, how did John Muir become the muse for Chance?
For one, I grew up in the southern part of the state in the Portage area, actually outside of a town called Markazan, which is just a farming community. But we were stone's throw from Muir's homestead. And so my family, and particularly my father, was very much into Muir and what he stood for and just the naturalist way of life. So when... it was about, maybe 6-7 years ago, I felt like I really wanted to combine my artistic goals with something that could help the environment, possibly. And so we started looking around. Cheryl had written some things a while ago, this a great poem that we built a piece around. We wrote a piece for chamber orchestra and chamber choir called Fields, a Cantata for the Peaceful Rain. And that was built on a poem of Cheryl's, and probably 60-70% of this Muir show are distillations of those pieces. And when I started reading Muir and I noticed this correlation between Cheryl's poem and the way Muir wrote, I thought, well, they're talking about the same things. Sometimes they're even using the same language. That's the ticket. That's how we can put things together and have it feel seamless. So that's what we did.
America. We settled in the Wisconsin wilderness a few miles from the Portage, in a sunny woods overlooking a pond which Father named Fountain Lake.
Cheryl, can you talk about the phrase University of the Wilderness?
It was it came from something that John Muir actually coined, that phrase. And I don't know which particular reading or book it came from, but he was likening the woods to the University of the Wilderness. And he had a lot of analogies like that. A lot of the narrations that we use in our show come from some of his works that are just wonderful as far as quotes and things that he wrote. I've fallen deeply in love with John Muir's writings. I've been a big reader most of my life. And just the way that he wrote about everything that he did is just really entrances me. We took sections from a work called John of the Mountains, which was one of my favorite works of his. Story of My Boyhood and Youth was another one. My First Summer in the Sierra. And some of these readings are just fantastic, and I'm not sure which one of those that was coined from.
I actually...
Do you know that one?
Yeah, I do know that
one. We're not mere scholars, by the way. Just we just love the guy.
Yeah.
He's our Earth Day guy.
I remember that because there's a point in our program where Muir needed money, and he had to go and get a job, basically, and he went to Indianapolis, and he worked in this factory, and he was so mechanically minded, as you probably know, you know, with his inventions, that he flourished there. And he said at some point it was so interesting to him that it threatened to endanger his work in the University of the Wilderness.
The need for money eventually drove me to take a job in a factory. I greatly enjoyed this mechanical work, and was so successful that my botanical and geological studies in the University of the Wilderness were in danger of being seriously interrupted.
Ed, in this piece, I understand this isn't a musical biography of John Muir. This is a kind of an attempt to capture this unique character and his philosophy. So how do you do that?
Well, when we were picking, we were perusing many of his writings, and we looked for things that would motivate a person to become the very interesting and eccentric person that he was. So we used that as kind of a filter when we were looking through and poring over all of his writings. We were looking for things that maybe like a psychologist might look. Where did that motivation come from? And we came upon things that, at least in our interpretation, for instance, his very tough childhood and his demanding and commanding father may have had a lot to do with why he was driven to all his free time to be out in the wild, you know, just to get out of there.
We never thought of playing truant. But after I was 5 or 6 years old, I ran away to the seashore or the fields most every Saturday and every day in the school vacations, except Sundays. Though solemnly warned that I must play at home in the garden and backyard, lest I should learn to think bad thoughts and say bad words.
And we were looking for things like that led to the shaping of this, just such an unusual and dedicated person.
So what we've tried to do on the readings and the music that we've chosen is to really show him in a multidimensional light, and a real emotional range of the man. He's not just sniffing flowers all the time.
But he did that.
He did a lot of that.
He sniffed some flowers.
He did
sniff flowers.
There's one reading where he goes, his method of study is to sit down by a rock.
For a minute or a day, to hear what it had to tell. I asked the boulders I met whence they came and where they were going.
Yeah. Cheryl, do you feel like, obviously none of us have met John Muir, given the time difference. Do you feel like you know this guy, having gone through this process?
I do. I really do. I think that sometimes when you write things, you get in a stream, and you believe that you're all by yourself in that stream, and then you discover something later that you have an amazing affinity for. And that's what happened to me as a poet and a librettist with John Muir's writing. He really spoke to me. So.
Hey, Rob, could I interject one thing on here? As far as the association between Cheryl and John Muir, my favorite one of my favorite parts of our program is this part where John Muir tells everyone that they shouldn't hike in the woods, they should saunter. So
saunter.
They should saunter in the woods. And if you've ever, well, you never have, but I'll tell you, if you go in the woods with Cheryl, you better have time. And you better be ready to look microscopically at 10 yards and not have a goal, anything else except have a really great, fulfilling, enriching time. So when we found that, we just go, that's got to be in there.
Well, I love that, because I definitely, if I am thinking the word hike, I'm covering some ground, man. I'm getting from the beginning
to the
end. Yeah, Cheryl, talk about your love. Maybe it wasn't intentional, but your love of sauntering in the wilderness.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think I'm a microscopic creature. There's one reading I love when he talks about transmicroscopic creatures being our fellow mortals with man. And I've just always felt like that there's, you know, microcosms and macrocosms. And I've always been fascinated by that. And I love to stare at things. I love to ponder things. I close the museum down. I'm the last one there, reading all the things. And I just have always been that way. It was something innate.
Ed, we've heard a lot about Cheryl's kind of personal kinship with John Muir. Is there something about your character that you feel like connects with him?
I would say that I've always been one to look for an alternate route that's slightly off the main trail. So that's been musically what I've done my whole life. But a lot of the influence came, I have to say, from my parents, who were Muir heads. You know, there were a few big influences in our household, and he was definitely one of them.
And Cheryl, as we wrap up, we're marking the 180th anniversary of John Muir's birth this weekend. Can you make a case that maybe we should all become a little more Muir heads ourselves?
I think he's got such wonderful ways to put things. I've always believed that words are carriages that take you somewhere. And I know his words certainly have taken me to some places that I loved going to. And I can't speak more highly of somebody who puts such beautiful phrases together and images. And so I would recommend anybody reading his stuff. It's really good.
Cheryl and Ed, thanks for talking and performing with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Cheryl, Leah, and Ed Willett are the team that make up the music duo Chance. We talked with them about their show, John Muir, University of the Wilderness. They'll perform that show this Sunday, Earth Day, at the National Great Lakes Visitor Center in Ashland. The show starts at 2 p.m. Chance also performed a few songs and readings for us from our studio in Superior. You can listen to those at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up after the news, it's Food Friday. We'll add some heat to salads, entrees, even desserts with hot sauce. I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll find out how performance-based funding could affect UW system schools as part of our state news roundup. First, it's Food Friday, and this week we're talking about hot sauce. You can find hot sauce just about anywhere in the world, but no two are made alike. The wide spectrum of spice and flavor means you can use them on just about any kind of food. You can call in with your favorite hot sauce and how you use it at 800-642-1234. What dishes are you always looking to spice up? Has your taste for hot sauce changed over time? Do you ever use hot sauce as an ingredient instead of just a condiment? And do you like it as hot as it can get? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lori Skelton is a classical music host here at WPR and a regular guest here on Food Friday. Lori, welcome back.
I'm a little disappointed. I was expecting music that had something to do with fire.
A little zestier.
That was really
music.
Mellow.
That was, yeah, that was a little chilly. Well, we'll have to heat it up a little.
All right.
So a lot of people, Lori, I think about hot sauce and they just think about the heat, but there's a lot more flavor going on, right, than just that, like, that burning sensation.
I think one of the things that is so exciting right now is that maybe if you did grow up with that jar of Tabasco that you occasionally brought out, there's so much more to choose from these days. People are getting very, very inventive with the peppers that they choose. People are getting very inventive with other ingredients that are added. And I do want to make a distinction for this program, at least. I am talking hot sauce. I'm not talking salsa. For one thing, salsas are very often fresh. They're made with chopped ingredients that are meant to be eaten in fairly large quantities, whether on chips or with vegetables or on other foods, and meant to be eaten relatively quickly. When I'm talking hot sauce, I'm talking about the things that need cooking and the things that, as you say, you're probably not going to use a lot of, but you can have one, two. At the moment, I have three different hot sauces in my kitchen that I use on a fairly regular basis. And then, of course, you go out to dinner and what's the sauce on the table? There's a chance to try something new.
Let's talk about what gives hot sauce the heat. And that, I guess, is capsaicin, something that comes out of chili peppers.
Right. Now, peppers are the fruit of the plant of the nightshade family. And there is a range of peppers starting with bells, which don't register at all on the Scoville heat scale, which is how heat of peppers is judged. You start with something like a jalapeno. That will go 1,000 to 10,000 Scoville heat units. Chipotle, which is a pepper that's had a little bit of aging, and that's going to get a little bit higher, up to 3,000. Cayenne, 10,000 to 100,000. Tabasco, 30,000 to 50,000 Scoville units. Habanero scotch bonnets, those start at 100,000 and can go up to 350,000. Then you get into things like ghost peppers, which can start at 850,000 and go up to 1,000,000. You can get very, very creative, but you can also get really, really scared if you dive in too deep too quickly.
Yeah, one of those super hot peppers that was in the news lately, somebody just ate one of those raw and got something that I'd never heard of called thunder headaches. Do not do this at home,
no,
I guess is the lesson there.
No, it's interesting. When you think about the sensation of heat in the mouth, this is not one of the standard flavors. This isn't the sweet, salty, sour, bitter, the umami. What heat does, what those capsaicins do, is they bind on your tongue and then they affect how your neurons affect. It's almost like you're getting it in your brain rather than on your tongue, believe it or not. And so eating chili peppers is going to enhance other flavors in food. It's said to release endorphins, which is one of the reasons why I think a lot of people go for that burn. It can make you sweat, so if you're in a hotter climate, it can actually cool you down. I'm not going to go into, is it healthy? That gets into medicine that I flat out don't know. But you, even in countries where a lot of hot peppers are consumed, children, for the most part, need to be introduced to it relatively slowly. You do have to build up your tolerance over time.
And you mentioned countries where people eat hot sauces, and you gave us a little rundown. A lot of places around the world have their own and often very unique and distinct hot sauce traditions.
Well, hot sauces, peppers, hot peppers, got their start in Mexico, Central and South America. They have been around in those cultures for over 6,000 years. And so, but oddly enough, once Europeans came, it took a matter of decades before hot peppers started showing up in Europe and Africa and Asia. So a lot of us think about Mexican hot sauce, and you compare your basic Mexican hot sauce to something like Tabasco or Louisiana hot sauce. Mexican hot sauces are more reliant on the peppers and on any other ingredients you add to add flavor. They're not as reliant on vinegar, which is a big component of a lot of the hot sauces we have in America, the Louisiana-style hot sauce. You get into the Caribbean. Those are going to have a lot of fruit and vegetables as well as vinegar. Scotch bonnets are really common in Jamaica, for instance. Trinidad Scorpion, one of the absolute hottest, is one of the ones that came out of the Caribbean. And then you get into China, where you have hot peppers that are often blended with fish or shrimp pastes. Those are a little bit thicker, but you can also have hot sauces that are just chilies in oil. And those are really great for colder dishes. The one I'm enjoying the most right now, especially when I go out to dinner, is the Korean hot sauce that I believe is pronounced gochujang. This has not only occasionally fermented peppers, but fermented soybean paste. And that's going to give you an incredible depth of flavor.
It's Food Friday. We're talking about hot sauce with Lori Skelton. You can join in with your favorite hot sauce and how you use it at 800-642-1234. We'll bring on a caller now. Tom is with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
Hi. I've got my kitchen cabinet open, and I'm looking at least 40 different varieties.
Wow.
And I've got 40. Four out of the refrigerator. But I do have one here known as Jersey Death Sauce, which came with a little skull attached to the bottle and features a skull on the label. And it says this product contains the hottest known ingredients on the planet Earth. Please use with extreme caution.
Does it say what kind of pepper is in it?
Yes, it's a blend of habanero, cayenne, vinegar, then some pepper paste, I guess, that they put in there.
And Tom, let me ask what you do with...
It'll ruin anything you try to cook.
What do you do with these pepper, hot sauces, Tom? Do you use them in your cooking or sprinkle them on your food?
Yes, I use them quite a bit, and I'd like to just put in a plug for a Madison-based hot sauce person, Dash Alito's, who has Green Fire, Green Owl, Undertow, Red Honey. They're, you know, you can get them in local stores here.
Wow. Tom, thank you so much for sharing that. And that's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, there's some people who are really into hot sauce and collect them. And two, it's kind of like craft breweries. It seems like everywhere you go, there's local hot sauces these days, Lori.
I have really gotten to love Bushel and Peck's out of Beloit. They sell their stuff at the farmer's market in Madison. I actually brought in a couple of their sauces to taste, and One of them that's relatively new, is using a pepper that I'd never heard of called a Fatale pepper. They blend, it's a fairly hot yellow pepper, and they blend that with those lovely mild bell peppers, throw in some carrots and mustard and turmeric. And it's got a lovely fruity, citrusy flavor. They've got grapefruit juice in that, and I'm planning to use that on all of my fruit salads this summer. Their Fatale attraction is really a love.
And I wanted to bring up a point, especially for the hotter ones. You told us they're better in something with some fat in it.
There is something about needing the fat, whether it's to either spread it out on your tongue a little bit or to punch up that wonderful flavor. When I had a hot sauce taste testing earlier this week, I had tofu that was seared in olive oil. And I, just for the heck of it, I dipped a piece of raw tofu in one of the sauces. And I noticed all I was getting was the heat. I wasn't getting any real flavor beyond that. So there's something about having fat that does make a difference. Now, capsaicinoids are fat soluble. So if you do have a dish that is just too hot, one thing you shouldn't do is reach for a glass of water. You want something with dairy in it to, again, spread that out. You're better off drinking some milk, adding some sour cream to the dish. Another thing that will help if you are eating something that is just too hot, add some rice. Rice will help take some of that heat out, which is a reason why a lot of cuisines that use hot sauces will have rice in the dish.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to WPR's Lori Skelton about cooking with hot sauce. And in a bit, she'll tell us how to make our own hot sauce. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite hot sauce? Do you have a collection, as Tom did? Have you made your own hot sauce? And how do you use hot sauce in your cooking? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Fire.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is spicing up our cooking, adding little fire as we explore the wide world of hot sauce. There you go, Lori.
Thank you so much.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite hot sauce? Have you made your own? What do you like to cook with hot sauce or sprinkle it on right at the end? Call 800-642-1234. Lori, before we go back to our callers, we've got a recipe, WPR.org/Food Friday. Not to use hot sauce, but to make our own.
Basic hot sauce is you just cook down chili peppers with salt and vinegar and then puree it. You can get more complex if you start with a cooked fruit or vegetable and then add your pepper for heat and flavor. Now, with that in mind, one thing I didn't see a lot of were serrano pepper sauces. There are some out there, but it's not as prevalent as jalapeno or habanero. And I thought, what a great thing for Wisconsin. Let's take the serrano, which is a very bright, sharp hot pepper, and combine it with something Wisconsin spring and get a spring fever hot sauce. I thought, great, I can use ramps because alliums are a great addition for hot sauces. The weather being what it is, I wasn't able to get the ramps. Tried making it with wild garlic, cooked it down. It certainly was hot. It certainly was garlicky, but beyond that, I didn't find it very interesting. And I guess with this particular bright heat, even if you want that to be the predominant flavor, I think you're going to need something to ground it. So what I've got for a recipe this month is something that I haven't yet made. We've got it up there in case anybody wants to experiment with it. 8 ounces of serrano peppers, 4 ounces of ramps, bulbs, and leaves, 1 to 2 chopped carrots, cup of white vinegar. You're going to cook that down. First, bring it to a boil. Let it boil for about 3 minutes. Then give it a gentle simmer for about 20 minutes. Let it cool. Taste for salt and sweet. You're going to want to add a little bit of salt. You're going to want to add, I think, some honey. There's a Wisconsin pantry staple from over the winter. So you've got the carrots from the earth. You've got that grounding sweetness. And I think that's what's going to make this hot sauce worth work. I'm obviously not going to have
a chance. Waiting for the ramps.
Waiting for the ramps. So as soon as I know that I can make it, I'll let you know. And if anybody wants to try it, if you've got the jump on me ramp-wise, please let me know how it works.
Try it. Check that out at WPR.org/Food Friday. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Gene is with us in Almond. Gene, hi.
Hi. That's a nice segue into the recipes that I wanted to share. I started making my own hot pepper sauce, growing my own hot peppers and making my own pepper sauces. And one of the simplest that I make, and also I've learned that if you ferment your peppers before you make your sauce, you get a much better flavor, and you don't have to add vinegar then. It's much less acidic, and you don't get the real nasty burn in the butt in the morning and that after.
Okay.
But one of my simplest recipes is just red serrano peppers and fermented, and use a Caldwell fermentation starter. Okay. For that, and then I just grind them up. I actually puree them cold, uncooked, and then you mix a little bit of cooked sweet potato with it, and that's pureed. And then just a little bit of maple syrup.
Wow.
And a bit of, I use a pink Himalayan salt. And then you have to add a little bit of filtered water, or it's a little too thick, unless you like it thick. But I use a small neck bottle, and it doesn't come out as well.
That sounds fantastic.
Gene, thank you so much. Yeah, you were excited all the way through there. Fermenting peppers. That is a lot of food traditions around the world. They'll ferment the peppers.
Exactly. And you can start off, as Gene does, with a fermented product, or you can make your hot sauce and then let it ferment. He makes a very good point. The more acid you've got in your hot sauce, the less likely it is to ferment. So if you want something that's less acidic, you may want to start off with things that have had a chance to bubble and squeak a little bit beforehand. He's using red serranos, which are the riper version. If you get green serranos in the store for cooking, they're great. But if you can wait for red ones, they do have a more complex flavor. And he was using Himalayan pink salt. I saw so many suggestions for if you don't know what to do with that flavored salt they gave you at Christmas. Hot pepper sauces are a great way to use flavored salts. You really get, again, to boost that flavor profile. It's wonderful. Gene's got something great going here. Sweet potatoes, brilliant idea.
Yeah, I would never have thought of that in a hot sauce. Gene, thanks so much for that call at 800-642-1234. It's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is with us. We're talking about hot sauce, using it, buying it, and making it. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Janesville. Tom, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, first of all, I want to say that I absolutely prefer the Louisiana-style hot sauces. But the reason I called is to follow up on your comments about fat and capsaicin.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the Anchor Bar in Buffalo, New York, where they invented the buffalo wings and the hot sauce that they use for them.
Frank's Red
and of
Hot.
Course, they have there that are like from nuclear to volcanic to, you know, all the way down to mild. I asked the chef how they make all the different heats of sauce, and he said they simply start out with the very hottest that you can hardly stand, and then they just add melted butter. Keep adding it until they get it. It just makes it milder and milder and milder until you get to the level that you want.
Interesting.
And so that's the fat on the capsaicin.
Are you a fan of the buffalo sauce yourself, Tom?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing that.
He reminds me a lot of how New Mexico makes hot sauces for their dining. They'll very often thicken them with a roux of flour and lard. So right there is another way that fat will play with heat and bring out more of that flavor.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's get into a little more about how to use it. I mean, there's some of the obvious things. Just sprinkling it on eggs is fantastic, burgers, whatever. You are thinking maybe even desserts. Is that right, Lori?
A couple of years ago, before Central Time started, I had a chance to interview the guy who wrote the Sriracha Cookbook, a chance to use that lovely condiment, which in Thailand is actually thicker than the way we serve it. But instead of just sprinkling it on your eggs or sprinkling it over your pulled pork sandwich, how to use it in recipes. And one of the real surprises for everyone here was I made sriracha chocolate truffles. Now, we know Mexican hot chocolate is going to have a little bit of chili pepper to bring out the depth, the complexity of the chocolate. And the same thing can happen with hot sauces. One of the things that was suggested when we did the hot sauce tasting up here is maybe if you've got a hot fudge sundae and your hot fudge sauce is not the greatest, maybe it's a little too sweet, a little too cloying, why not sprinkle a little hot sauce on your hot fudge sundae? Or if somebody brings a fruit pie and it's a store-bought pie that's maybe not the greatest quality, it's a little too, again, too sweet, too stodgy, too boring, sprinkle a little hot sauce on the pie under the crust and you're really going to wake up those fruit flavors.
And then for the recipe we have online at WPR.org/Food Friday for that springtime hot sauce here in Wisconsin.
Spring fever hot sauce.
Spring fever, that's it. If you do finally get those ramps and make it, what are you thinking of doing with this stuff?
Because this is a bright flavor, I am hoping to use it to jazz up the last of the winter vegetables. That said, don't do steamed vegetables. You again need that fat. This would be great with a stir fry. And if you wanted to get creative and stir fry some turnips or parsnips or some of the boring root vegetables, go for it. We come back to the idea of maybe with fruit. The other thing hot sauce loves, as we know, is things with salt. So this is a great way to counteract maybe a mistake you've made in the kitchen. If you oversalted a dish, grab a bottle of hot sauce and see what you can do to play with the flavors.
Do you grow hot peppers, Lori, assuming that there's, you know, not snow on the ground for the rest of the summer?
I have grown hot peppers in the past, and based on the amount of cooking I've been doing with serranos in just like curries and things, my boyfriend took one look at the Spring Fever hot sauce and says we're going to triple our Serrano production this year.
All right.
So we'll just see what happens.
It's an industry. Lori, thanks a lot for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you.
That's Lori Skelton. She's a classical music host here at WPR and one of our go-to food experts. She joined us on this edition of Food Friday to talk about hot sauces, different ways to use them, and to make your own hot sauce. You can find her recipe for that Spring Fever hot sauce we've been talking about at WPR.org/Food Friday. Give it a try, give it a tweak, and then let us know how it works out. You can email ideas@WPR.org. And there's still time for you to weigh in on your favorite kind of hot sauce, your favorite way to use it. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR and share your story while you're there. Are you worried about the robot takeover? It may be happening sooner than you think. Inventors in Singapore have invented new robots, robots that have accomplished what many humans cannot. The two robots put together IKEA furniture without a manual, in less than 21 minutes, and without breaking up any relationships along the way. Jay Carlisle Larson is in the studio. You, JC, have put together the IKEA furniture in your life.
I definitely have. I think that probably for the sake of my relationship, I've done it by myself, especially because I'm very bad at it. It usually takes me about 5 hours to put together something from IKEA. Was immediately jealous of these robots.
Yeah, I've never done IKEA furniture, but I've done that, you know, kit furniture,
sure.
A shelf, whatever. And it can be a pain, kind of deciphering these manuals. The impressive thing, did you watch the video? PBS NewsHour had that, right?
Of course I watched the video.
And coordinating the way the two robot arms coordinated and smoothly picked
it's
up
amazing.
And twisted. And,
yeah. It's just no human will ever be able to do that.
No pair of humans, is the key.
I mean, I don't know. Definitely no pair of humans. If there's one thing that will definitely cause a fight, friends, family, it's trying to put together some IKEA furniture.
All right, well, let me be the first to welcome our new robot overlords. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.